So who here has absolutely no idea what I'm going to talk about and has never heard of the E1 software-defined interface before?
No, it exists.
You know it exists, okay. it doesn't actually yet, but that's the whole point. Right. So there was a previous talk at OsmoCon in 2018, where I presented kind of the state of things. And here I'm going to try to focus on what I've been working on, and which is the the implementation that uses an ICE40 FPGA as a basis for the implementation of this. So because I just did the ICE40 before, I'm going to just start with the hardware. So that's the first prototype. I'm not really sure if I showed it in before, but that was based on an Arduino board, which is a UP5K development board, which has horrible, horrible layout and is pretty much non-functional until you beef up the ground connection so that there isn't ground bounce around and you add decoupling capacitors and kind of stuff. That's just to get it working. And then that's the mess of wires with my different attempts at doing an E1-Fi. I made a new board, which is this one, and it's meant to plug into the icebreaker that I mentioned before. So it has a dual PMOD connector, and this includes that's the clock part. So it's a 30.72 megahertz clock, because that's pretty much the only clock. If you divide it by 15, you get 2.048 for E1. And I don't remember the exact ratio, but you can actually multiply it with the ICE40 PLL into 48 megahertz for USB. And so you have a Bose clock from one crystal. That's the USB interface. It's really just direct connection to the FPGA pins. You just have like the series resistor for I'm not sure why, but yeah, impedance matching, I'm gonna say. That's the E1 PHY that uses only FPGA IOs. That's the way it works. So I'm still using, obviously, a transformer. I tried doing without the transformer, but using only capacitive coupling couldn't make it work. Like, I can make either TX or RX work, but when you have both, you have too much common mode noise leaking from one to the other, and that doesn't work. So, okay, I actually have to use a transformer. Technically, I only need a transformer on one of the two sides, either RX or TX. It doesn't make sense because they don't sell half a transformer. So it just.
You wind it yourself?
Yeah, right. So the transmit side is very simple. It's basically two resistors, and you just send the pulse on one or the other. So you're going to have 3 volts divided by the impedance or whatever. And so if you use a one... Sorry? Right, yeah. So the physical layer link of on E1 is you get positive pulse or negative pulse when it's a 1, and you have no pulse when it's a 0. That's the kind of levels that you would find of the line. So you get a positive voltage, a negative voltage, or nothing. And then you have a bunch of encoding to transform your bits into those pulse so that you don't get too many runs of zeros, because you would lose low synchronization. And so there is bit stuffing. It's not bit stuffing. It's something else, whatever. It's called HDB3 encoding, and so you get positive, negative pulses, and that's basically what you need to detect. Either a positive pulse, a negative pulse, or no pulse. That's kind of a trinary encoding. And so here, if you toggle that I/O and not this I/O, you get a positive pulse. If you do the opposite, you get a negative pulse, and if you don't do anything, well, you don't get many pulse. And so, yeah, TX is very easy. Detecting on the RX side is much more complicated. This takes more components. That's just the termination resistor. Like, the nominal impedance of the line is 120 ohms, so you put a 120 ohm resistor there to terminate the line. And then you need to detect pulses that go up or pulses that go down. Now, this circuit is made to be entirely symmetrical. That's actually pretty important because if you load one side more than the other, you get asymmetries and stuff like that. And so this has been designed to be as symmetrical as possible to get the best possible signal integrity and detection. I tried an asymmetric one. It works more or less, but this provides better result with, I think, it takes like two more capacitors and two more resistors, which really doesn't matter. So the general idea is that you, again, use the FPGA differential I/O as comparators, and you pre-bias them to be off, which means, so all the p-bias here are slightly lower than negative bias. So basically, I'm biasing this at 0.33 times the VCC, so like 1.1 volts. I bias this, this is biased, sorry, at 1.1 volts. This is biased at 2.2 volts, which means that by default, all the comparators are off. And then when a pulse arrives in one direction or the other, it will push both I/O in one direction or the other. So if you look, you know, if you have a positive pulse, it will turn the comparator more off for one of them and actually turn it off, turn it on for the other. I mean, yeah, if you look at the connection, it makes sense, but I'm not sure how to explain it. But basically, yeah, when you get a pulse, you just change that bias point enough so that in one of the cases it turns it on, and on the other, well, it bias it in the wrong direction, which means it's already off, so it's just more off, I say, but whatever. I mean, it's off with more margin, okay, right. All the bias voltage, in this test board, they're programmable, so I use, again, precedence knee modulation with just less filtering to generate them, but really, what I found, you can generate them with just a resistor divider, and that's going to be fine. That's what I'm going to do in the final hardware version. Yeah, I mean, I wanted to test, to run a, like long-term bit error rate measurements with different bias level to see exactly how much that influenced the bit error rate, basically. Because if your bias is too great, then your pulse, of course, your pulse is not good enough to overcome the bias. But if it's too small, it will actually detect pulses that aren't there. So yeah. So that's for the hardware interface to the FPGA. So now, what exactly is in that FPGA? Well, obviously, I put it's a E1 to USB. So there's an E1 core and there's a USB core in there. But coding everything in Verilog hardware description language would be inflexible and not so software-defined, as Harald would say. And so the general architecture is that inside the FPGA, I created a custom system of on-chip, which has a RISC-V soft core that's, you know, executing a software like you would find on the Atmel or whatever. And it just has dedicated peripherals to accomplish this goal. And so those peripherals would be the USB core itself, which I presented before, and the E1 peripheral that does all the physical interfacing as well as all the E1 framing and deframing. And it can receive and transmit E1 multiframes. I should have put a diagram of an E1. Give me a second. Okay, so that's an E1 frame looks like, more or less. There's actually a bug, but whatever, you won't notice it. if anybody can point me the bug in there, no. Anyway, that's what an E1 frame looks like. So you have 32 time slots. Each of the squares is one bit, right? So we have 32 time slots, and then you have 16 frames, and that's divided into a first sub-multiframe and a second sub-multiframes. And the sub-multiframes are relevant for the CRC computation, basically. And so the E1 core in that system on chip will take care of finding the alignment of that frame structure into the bitstream, and you just tell him, okay, the next multiframe you receive, you write it at this particular address in memory, and it will do this. And you have a classic, you know, FIFO of buffer descriptors, both for transmit and for receive. For transmit, instead of finding the frame alignment, well, it will actually generate it and correctly generate all the fixed bits here to provide the remote end with the alignment. Okay, so that's what the E1 core does, and it stores all the data into a giant 64K buffer. I mean, giant in relation to E1, it's actually a pretty long buffer. You don't have to use all of it, of course. And to lower the computational load on the soft core, there is actually a DMA core that can copy data between the E1 buffer and the USB transmit and receive buffers. So when you receive a multiframe, you can just issue a couple of DMA commands that copy them in the next USB frame to be transmitted. The other peripheral that you find, you can control the LED. You can talk to the flash, which is useful to implement DFU, for instance, so that you can actually, from USB, update both the FPGA bitstream and the software image that runs on it. One interesting feature of the ICE40 that I forgot to mention is that it has a so-called warm boot. And so you can boot by default a safe image, and then the fabric itself can tell the configuration logic to go and fetch a new bitstream from the different address in the configuration flash. So you can have the same bootloader and then user image that you would find in a classic microcontroller and have a safe update path. You have a PDM, which is, again, pulse density modulation, that controls the bias voltage and will help for clock tuning. Because one of the goals, of course, of this is to provide a stable E1 clock to the base station, because most of them will lock the internal OCXO to the incoming bitrate of the E1. So yeah, something it's missing currently at the moment is a GPS DO. I didn't have any when I made the board, but it's really simple logic to add to the FPGA. And a debug UART. And then you have the main RAM and the boot RAM. That's actually necessary because as I said, it has a lot of memory in a single port RAM in 1 megabits. The downside of this is you can't initialize it, which means it comes unconfigured. Once the FPGA is booted, that large area of RAM contains random data. It's not even zeroed out or anything. Which, of course, your soft core still needs to boot from something. Thankfully, the small memory blocks, those can be initialized from the bitstream. And so what I'm doing is I'm using two of those block RAMs as the boot ROM mapped at address 0. And they contain, by default, a small assembly bootloader that will use the SPI peripheral to go and load the actual application program into the large memory and then jump to it. And then that small memory zone is then used as the stack space for the C runtime. I think that's pretty much it for the hardware side of things. The software running on this is currently very basic in the sense that I've got an E1 test software that implements a loopback. So you know every buffer it receives, it just feeds it to the transmit core. And I tested that this actually works just fine, which kind of validates the receive and transmit path. I also have a working USB stack, and by that I mean something that responds sufficiently good to the control transfer to be enumerated. I tested isochronous transfers as well, at least the receive part. I didn't test the transmit part, but there's no reason that wouldn't work. But I don't have an actual firmware that implements what's actually needed to do that. That's something I was hoping to be done by now, but I had some issues last week that needed debugging and lost a bit of time on there. So, but I'll be working on that next. I did some work also on the host side of things, because you need something to, well, talk to that dongle and basically bridge USB to Osmo BSP and Osmo BSC, yeah, Osmo BSC and Osmo MGW, I think, is going to need to talk to that. And so both can't talk to the USB device. So the general idea is to have a daemon that we call Osmo 1D that's going to allow client application to open and close time slots and stuff like that. And that's the, well, I'm going to start with that. That's really the, that's the client API for that daemon, is that you can query different things. So you have a interface level, a line level, and a time slot level, and you can query information about them. Mostly, well, for interface, you can mostly query how many lines it has, and line, I think the only thing you get as a status currently is if it's up or down. And then time slots, you have different mode, HDLC, or raw mode, and when you open, all those communication go over Unix sockets, and so when you call a TS open, it actually enables the time slot and actually starts transmitting whatever you send it. Because it's over Unix sockets, when you send the packet to open it, what you get back is an actual file descriptor, which you can just write your packets to. And yeah.
You're doing file descriptor passing then?
Yes. Since it was possible, I figured that. Oh yeah, sorry. The question was if I was doing a file descriptor passing, and yes, the message you get back has the status, and if the status is okay, you actually get a file descriptor through the Unix socket, and that file descriptor uses socsec packet. And it's created with socket pair, basically. The protocol is made to be very small and easy. It's a few fixed size structure, which, you know, map one-to-one to the query, and with just a provision for a version number if at some point we want to extend it or things like that. But at the moment I mostly implemented the server and client logic and how they talk to each other, but there is not actually the communication to the USB side, because the USB side isn't implemented yet. So anyone that wants to help with that, or to actually use that API to go into Libosmo Abyss to add support for it in there and in whatever Osmo MGW uses. Does it use also Libosmo? At the moment, it's not supported at all. So the support for E1 needs to be introduced at all for Osmo MGW.
Osmo Abyss.
Right, yeah. And that's pretty much all I have. So if anybody has any questions.
So first of all, I think it's amazing how much effort you put into it. It's really, it's a very, very, how can I say, I enjoy very much observing it. I would love to do something with it, but time is of course always a constraint.
Yeah.
The RISC-V, this Pico RISC-V existed using unmodified. So because I think at some point you would think about
I did code my own microcontroller also for the ICE40. I didn't mention it because I didn't have time to draw a diagram for the internals of it. And so I coded actually my own 16-bit microcontroller with its own instruction set and compiler, assembler and C compiler. But because I was under the assumption that the RISC-V would be too big, but through some configuration, I could reduce the size of the PiCore V32 RISC-V, and also manage to clock it fast enough. Originally, I wanted to clock all the logic at 48 megahertz, which is just not possible for the PiCore V32. At the moment, I actually don't meet timing for this. But given the huge timing margin I have that I show in the overclocking thing, it works just fine, even 20% faster than I need it to. I draw this zone is what's clocked at 48 megahertz, which is only the USB core. I might actually implement a cross clock. This block crosses clock domain for the wishbone internal bus between 30.72 and 48. I might actually run the SoC itself at 24 megahertz to meet timing in the future if need be. But at the moment, it works just fine. And I'm kind of hoping the open source tools will evolve enough to meet timing.
What's that? And how much capacity do you use in the FPGA?
So at the moment, I'm using around 70% of the logic inside the FPGA, the majority of which is actually taken by the PiCore V32. The PiCore V32 basically takes about 1,500 logic elements, and I'm at 3,000. So it's like a half the design is that. Ideally, in the final board, I'd like to put two E1 interfaces because I have the IOs for it, and I think it would enable some interesting use to have two interfaces, like a active sniffer or actively be able to inject the data into one time slot and not the other. Or that kind of stuff that you can do if you have two interfaces, basically. Yeah. Okay, thank you.